How will you disrupt yourself?
On today's show,
challenging conventional advice, challenging bromides. That might be my calling, if I actually have one, is to say that, you know, in your vernacular, don't forget about the S-curve, because this course you're determined to stay on might have other ideas.
Welcome to the Disrupt Yourself podcast, where we discuss strategies and advice for how to climb the S-curve of learning in both your professional and personal life, disrupting who you are now to slingshot into who you want to be. I'm your host, Whitney Johnson. Today's guest is Mike Rowe. In his show, Dirty Jobs, Mike has shown millions of viewers around the world what it takes to do extraordinary jobs that don't get talked about on Career Day, but are critical to a well-functioning society. Mike has covered more than 300 dirty jobs, including garbage collecting, animal husbandry, pest extermination, salt mining, concrete finishing, worm poop ranching, and well, you get the idea. Mike has written a book titled The Way I Heard It and has an equally popular podcast by the same name. As a serial S-curve jumper, Mike started his career as a professional opera singer. He joined the QVC shopping channel, where he was fired for, in his words, making fun of productions and belittling viewers. Getting canned from a cushy home shopping gig is what ultimately led him to the bottom of that career-defining S-curve that fans know him for today. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. You make me sound interesting. I appreciate it.
I hope. You will live up to your billing. I'm confident. So I just finished reading your book, and you are such a terrific storyteller. I would love for you to tell us a few stories about some influential people in your life.
I guess I do that all of the time without really thinking too much about it. It's become kind of a default position for me. You know, Dirty Jobs fundamentally is a show about telling other people's stories. And in writing the book that you just finished, I did find myself looking back a lot at my own misspent youth and dubious career and, you know, trying to assign both credit and blame where necessary. And predictable, I suppose, but my parents had and continue to have a big influence on what I do, who I am, and how I think. My grandfather, in particular, had a bigger influence than I thought he had when he was alive. That happens a lot, right? You look back. It's only in looking back that you begin to realize the significance of a person or a thing or a seemingly inconsequential fork in the road that turned out to be completely determinative and who we become. For me, it was my grandfather, who was a tradesman. He only went to the seventh grade, had to drop out to work at a very young age. But by the time he was 30, he was an electrical contractor. And very skilled in every other discipline, from carpentry to plumbing, to steam fitting, to pipe fitting, heating, air conditioning, whatever. He was the guy who could take your watch apart and put it back together blindfolded. You know, he just had that chip, it seemed. I was pretty sure I'd follow in his footsteps. I set out to do that and learned when I was 17 that I had, well, I guess the lesson was, I realized just because you love something doesn't mean you can't suck at it. And the handy gene was recessive, tragically, and my grandfather pointed that out, but suggested that I could be a tradesman if I really wanted to be. I just needed to get a different toolbox. And that turned out to be hugely influential to me, got me thinking about entertainment, persuaded me to try things that frankly, I had no real interest in pursuing, things like singing, things like acting, things like writing and performing in front of a camera. That was never a part of my hopes, dreams, or aspirations. So, yeah, it was my pop who course corrected me at 16, 17 years of age. And around that same time, I had a scoutmaster who was really influential in my life. Didn't know it at the time, but he was pushing me in the same general direction. You know, in the Boy Scouts, I learned to memorize long stretches of poetry and songs and sing them at campfires and recite them. And it was really a study in being uncomfortable and getting out of your comfort zone. This was a different time. You know, the Boy Scouts, when I grew up in my troop, we had a boxing ring in the troop room where we settled our differences. You know, our scoutmaster was a retired drill sergeant. We went to the shooting range often. We learned to shoot. We learned to canoe. We learned all sorts of things. So that mattered in ways I didn't fully appreciate. I had a music teacher in high school named Mr. King, who literally, again, took me by the scruff of the neck and changed the trajectory of my thinking. I had good close friends in my life who, obviously, you know, any successful person or happy person has friends that make a difference in how they think and who they are. And today I have a business partner who's named Mary Sullivan, the Irish Hammer, I call her, who was also instrumental in, you refer to the S-curve, but I think of them in terms of people who say, look, not that way, this way, or maybe this instead of that, you know. Those are the people who, looking back, were most instructive. My grandfather, Fred King, Mary Sullivan, my parents, and a scoutmaster named Mr. Huntington.
You mentioned your grandfather said to you, you can be a tradesperson, but you might need to find a different toolbox. Was there an experience that you had where that became clear, or either that you weren't good at something, or he said, you know, Mike, you're actually really good at acting, or you're really good at singing. Why don't you go in this direction? Was it more of a push, or was it a pull?
It was more of a bounce. It was more of a, you know, of the ball in a pinball machine, you know, trying to get down to the bottom, just bouncing off of different things. I was so certain when I was 11, 12, 13, 14, that I would follow in his footsteps, that it never occurred to me that the skill that he had wouldn't somehow magically come to me. Mm-hmm. But what I learned was that some people just are naturally gifted when it comes to the mechanics of the trades, whether it's hanging sheetrock or running electric or basic architecture. I'm not completely incompetent in that world, but none of it came easy. And it really stayed that way until I was about 17. And I think we were putting in a patio on my mom's house. My grandparents, incidentally, lived right next door to my parents on a hilltop in Baltimore County. There was nobody else around for miles. We had the place to ourselves. And so we would go back into the woods every other day to cut the wood that fueled the wood stoves that kept our houses warm. It was that kind of a childhood. And so it never occurred to anybody to hire a contractor to put on a patio. My grandfather would do it. And I was his apprentice along with my dad. And I had mixed up the pour, you know, the concrete mixture is pretty specific. And I'd gotten that wrong. It was like the third thing I got wrong that day. And that was the moment when Pop was like, look, you know, you're my grandson. I love you. You can do this the rest of your life if you want, but you're beating your head against the wall. What you're really enamored of, he said, is not the business of building patios or porches or renovation. You're obsessed with the trades, but I don't think you're really obsessed with the construction trades. I think you're in love with the idea of being a jobber, of projects that have beginnings and middles and ends, and projects that allow you to work very hard for a concentrated period of time and then play very hard or do nothing at all. And he was right. That's the thing that I was really attracted to, beginnings and middles and ends. And so when I did kind of get over myself, and I didn't know what to do, but I knew I wasn't going to be able to do that. And so I went to a community college for 3 years and took every course I could. And then I worked for a little bit. And then I went to a university and took a very, very broad base of courses. I didn't want to major in anything. And so by the time I finished, as it turned out, I had a couple of different degrees. But the point is, it was a long, slow search to find something that made sense to my brain. And that something was a weird mix of writing, narrating, impersonating a host, and really looking at the entertainment industry like a tradesman would. And the word for it is freelancer.
Yeah.
I was in love with the idea of freelancing more than I was in love with the idea of doing any one particular thing. I just wanted to work in a way that gave me a measure of freedom and the satisfaction of completing a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. In my book, The Epigram, one of them anyway, is dedicated to Travis McGee, who famously said, "Be wary of all earnestness." But McGee was a character who I identified with so completely. He was a self-proclaimed bloody do-gooder who lived on a houseboat and came out of his premature retirement occasionally to help people recover that which had been conned from them. But his business model, I just loved his business model. The idea of taking your retirement early and then coming out of it from time to time when need demands, that appealed to me. And by the time I got to my mid-20s, I realized, you know, I can work in Hollywood. I can work in New York. I can work in entertainment and not swing for the fences and not try to look for a hit, but to simply focus on any project that came along and do the best I could and just be careful to avoid any encumbrances. And so that's
fascinating.
That's really what I did from 25 to 42. That's how I worked. That's how I fought. And prior to Dirty Jobs, that's why I had probably 1,000 different gigs in the entertainment space.
So that was clearly a formative experience for you. Is there another one or two experiences that you look at and you say, this made me who I am?
Well, Fred King, who I mentioned, was my high school music teacher. He was a lot more than that, as it turns out. But again, I didn't know it at the time. He came to Overly Senior High School the same year I did in 1978. And I was just looking for an easy class to take. So I signed up for the choir. I had no real interest in singing. This guy was a force of nature. And he was not just a brilliant musician. He was a former Golden Glove boxer. He was an All-State running back, played football. He was a Navy guy. This has always been a theme in my life, these big sort of weird poetic juxtapositions. You know, on the one hand, this guy's in charge of the Glee Club. He's an unapologetically sentimental softy who sometimes cries while he's conducting because he's just overwhelmed by the beauty of the music. He was also known as King of the Barbershoppers. He sang in a world champion barbershop quartet back in 1971 called the Oriole Four. And this is a world I didn't know anything about. I didn't know anything about music, period. I certainly didn't know anything about four-part harmony. And I suddenly find myself in this classroom with this guy who is a genuine tough guy. He didn't have any of his own teeth, interestingly. They had all been knocked out boxing and playing football. And the ones that hadn't, he had removed. And he had these dentures that he wore. But he also had 30 or 40 pair of joke teeth, like horrible looking teeth, like shaped like yellow thumbs. And this is just, and he wore these things on purpose just to freak people out, to see, you know, just to try and get a rise out of people. And that first day I met him, he had these awful, this awful set of teeth. They were like the gums. He had twice as many gums as you should have, right? Like, and baby teeth. He was wearing a set of dentures that were baby
so
teeth
gross.
And gums. It was so disgusting. And like, and he wasn't a handsome man to begin with. He kind of looked like Don Rickles, you know, only
Don
with really
Rictus.
Terrible teeth.
Sounds like Don Rictus.
Yeah,
more like
Don Rictus is right, man. Yeah, this frozen rictus of a smile. He was hideous and strange, but he sang so beautifully and he loved music so much that you couldn't help but get swept up in his passion for the arts. At the same time, you couldn't believe the filthy jokes he would tell you, the inappropriate comments he would make, and the ever-present prospect of violence. He had a horrible temper, and he threw things and slammed things around. He was just a force of nature. And I had a stutter at that point in my life. And when he realized, more of a stammer than a stutter, and when he realized that, he assigned me a solo and a song. You know, you can't stutter when you sing. Yeah. And it was a little bit out of my range, and I was very nervous and uncomfortable, but he insisted I do it. I mean, he demanded maybe stand up and sing it in front of the class, and we ultimately did it later in a performance. But during that day, you know, I was just so, I felt threatened, challenged, bullied, frightened, and profoundly uncomfortable. But he also said, look, Mike, I want you to stay after school. I'm going to work with you. And he did for a couple of weeks. And as it turned out, I had a weirdly low voice for a 17-year-old. And he wanted me to listen to this barbershop music because he thought I would relate to the bass part. And as it turns out, I did. And then he insisted, this was a couple of months later, but he insisted that I audition for the school play. Now, this was impossible because I was kind of shy, had a stammer. I had no interest in being on stage, but he demanded it and I trusted him. And so I learned a monologue and I auditioned and I stood on a stage. Mr. King was in the audience with about four or five other teachers and all the other hopefuls. And I started into this monologue and I was stammering the way I always do. I got about 20 seconds into it. It was painful. And he stopped me. He said, Mike, I love what you're doing with the character, but the character doesn't stutter. So do me a favor, stutter on your own time. Just give me the monologue without all that Porky Pig crap. And I don't know why, Whitney, but it was a combination. He made me kind of angry, but I also trusted him.
Yeah.
And I just simply started from the beginning. And 20 seconds into it, I wasn't stammering. And he kind of gave me this look from the audience and shrugged his shoulders. And to answer your question, that was a moment where I decided, you know, affirmatively decided that I would, from that point on, act like somebody who didn't stammer. And it sounds impossibly glib, but I swear it's true, that was not one of those moments where you look back on and go, oh, that was important. That was a moment where right there in real time, he grabbed me by the scruff of the neck, metaphorically, and just reoriented me in a different direction and said, so what if you're a 17-year-old kid who's not afraid to sing, who doesn't stammer? What does that kid look like? What does that kid do? And from that point on, I had the lead in most of the plays. There was no real limit. I mean, there were obvious limits to what I'm capable of, but I didn't put any governor on myself. And that's when I started thinking, you know, why not? As opposed to how could that ever be possible?
What a gift.
Yeah, it was. And I'll tell you something else. When he died on Labor Day, 2008, his funeral was attended by maybe 1,000 people. And what made that interesting was it was held in a small church and there was only room for maybe 300. And so 700 people were standing outside. And what made that interesting was a hurricane was blowing through Maryland and Baltimore on that day. The winds on the outside of that eye wall were, you know, 60, 70 miles an hour. And the rain was coming down sideways and people stood out there and listened to the entire service. Friends from the world of barbershop, but also a lot of former students. He had, in the same way Mr. Holland did, he touched a lot of people and he forced a lot of people to think differently about themselves. And he used music to do it, but he also used some really hideous teeth and a strange force of will. And, you know, when you have that kind of impact on people, well, sadly, you often don't know it until your own funeral. But hopefully he was looking down on that because it was a heck of a thing.
Mr. King was your Mr. Holland. I love that. One last question on that. Did you know you could sing?
I knew I could carry a tune. I had never sung in a choir. I had never sung alone. I had never sung in front of anyone. But, you know, in my mind, I knew that when I was singing along with the radio, that I could stay in tempo, stay in key, stay on pitch. That I understood. I didn't know what any of those words really meant at the time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But no, it was Fred King who, yeah, on that first day, you know, stood me up and made me sing a solo. There was no real warming up to it.
He was probably like, wait a second, this kid, he has a voice. He was probably surprised too.
He was a little surprised, but because my voice was low, the line from that very first thing was actually like a tenor line. And it was kind of painful. I could hit it, but it wasn't pretty. And then he walked me down to the piano, also in front of the class, and walked me down the scale. So it's like, la, 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 la. And he's like, okay, well, that's a low F. You're the only one in here with a low F. That makes you interesting. He gave me that album I mentioned, the Oriole 4 album, and I took it home.
Wait, what's this album that he gave to you?
Well, the quartet that he sang in that made him famous was called the Oriole 4.
Got it.
And he also was the director of a hugely influential group of men in my life who sang in a chorus called the Chorus of the Chesapeake. And so at the time, this gets in the weeds a little bit, but you might find it interesting because subcultures have since become a really important part of my life, all kinds of subcultures. But aside from the Boy Scouts, the one that had the most impact was called the Society for the Preservation and Encouragement of Barbershop Quartet Singing in America.
I love that. So 1920s.
It's completely 1920. In fact, it was founded in the mid-20s. And it grew by the time I joined in 1978. There were 35,000 men in many dozens of chapters all over the country. And these men in these choruses, they would compete with each other multiple times a year. And within these choruses, there were many dozens, hundreds of quartets. And so barbershop quartets and barbershop music became a really important thing in my teen years because Fred King was the master of that domain. And he gave me the album that they made many years ago, the Oriole 4, and I memorized the bass part to all the songs on it. Then he did something really interesting. He invited me and my best friend, a guy named Chuck, who still works with me to this day, to a meeting of the Chorus of the Chesapeake. And this would have been early in 1979. And that was my first real experience in a hyper-masculine world. In the same way that Fred King embodied these weird qualities of machismo with artistry, well, the entire chorus was that on steroids. This was 120 men, 125 men, many of whom fought in the Second World War, many of whom fought in Korea, some of whom fought in Vietnam, all much, much older than me. Remember, this 1978, so these are guys, you know, the average age was probably 60, but there were guys in there who were 90. And these men, they would stand for hours on end singing the most unapologetically sentimental songs you can imagine, songs about mom and best friends and going off to war and sweethearts and just song after song. And they would sometimes weep as they sang. It was a lot to take in for a 17-year-old. It was so far on the outside of cool, I can't even describe it to you. In fact, it was so uncool that I was fascinated by it.
Yeah.
And then after these rehearsals every Tuesday night, the men, they would go to a place called Johnny Jones, a bar in Highlandtown in Baltimore. And they would sit around these square tables with pitchers of National Bohemian beer, and they'd order crab cakes. And they'd sit there in quartets, and they would sing these old songs. Mm. And the first time I wandered into that weird, smoke-filled den of iniquity, I just fell in love with it, because the men would, they would teach me these songs from another time. It was just another soundtrack, another jukebox. And so I learned a lot of songs that were written 100 years ago, and that made me strange.
All right. Well, you know what you have to do now, right? You know what you have to do. You have to sing one of those songs.
Oh, man. Well, okay. So here's a song about a guy. He's going to prison for a very long time for a crime he didn't commit. And he has a three-year-old boy who he's likely never going to see again. Mm. The song's called Little Pal. And it's sung to the boy. And this is typical of the level of moroseness. You know, these songs, you know, there was no place to put grief, you know, the way... Well, there were few places to put it. And so in so many cases, you know, these horrible, gut-wrenching songs, they came out of a time when there was just no place to put the pain.
This was the container. They were these machismo men who couldn't talk about what they were feeling, so the songs became the container for their emotions, it sounds like.
That's right. So I'll tell you, you know, I'll circle back to Little Pal, but the memory I'll never shake, I walked into Johnny Jones and I saw four men sitting around one of these little tables, and they were all between 75 and 85, and they were all widowers. Mm-hmm. They had all lost their wives to either accident, tragedy, disease, whatever. And they were singing a song. This is even worse than Little Pal. It's called Dear Old Girl. And it's actually too brutal to sing, but hear the words. What has, dear old girl, it was a sunny day in June, and the birds were all in tune, and the songs they sang all made me think of you, and the words I came to speak brought the blushes to your cheek as you whispered yes and fondly kissed me too. I can see the love light shine in your bright eyes, sweetheart mine, as the preacher said the words that made us one. And you were a faithful wife through the changing scenes of life, till the master said your work on earth was done. That's just the verse. Then they get to the chorus, which goes, dear old girl, the robin sings above you. Dear old girl, it speaks of how I love you. And then it goes on, the blinding tears are falling as I think of my lost girl, and my broken heart is calling for you, dear old girl. Now, you have to imagine four old men singing this song in beautiful four-part harmony as tears are streaming down their faces. And sometimes the men who are sitting around watching them, they burst out laughing. And they're not laughing out of disrespect. They're laughing because these songs, they sometimes collapse under the weight of their own maudlin-ness. And then what happens is these four widowers finish singing this heartbreaking song about their dead wives, and some other quartet pipes up with, little pal, if daddy goes away, promise you'll be good from day to day. Do as mother says and never sin. Be the man your daddy might have been. Daddy didn't have an easy start. So this is the wish that's in my heart. What I couldn't be, little pal. I want you to be, little pal. And it goes on. I'm putting my faith and my hopes all in you to do all the things your dad could not do. I'll pray every night, little pal, that you'll turn out right, little pal. So, till we meet again, heaven knows where or when, don't forget about me, little pal.
Okay. Wow.
Can you imagine?
And you're 17. What an initiation into life. I mean, like, that was a rite of passage, without a doubt.
I'm standing in a bar that I'm not legally allowed to be in. I'm drinking beer that I'm not supposed to be drinking. I'm listening to the saddest songs in the world, sung by heroes of the Second World War. And in between, I'm invited to sit at the tables and listen to these war stories. Men who stormed machine gun nests, men with silver stars, men who won, you know, dogfights. I mean, it was the strangest mix of heroism, unapologetic sentimentality, fueled by beer and possibility. Now, that was a moment that I didn't realize would be nearly as important as it was. That was simply walking into a kind of time warp and suddenly being invited to participate in it. Now, remember, I've just memorized all the songs off the Oriole 4 International Championship album. And all the men in that bar, they knew those songs too. So suddenly Fred invites me to sit down and start singing the songs I had memorized off of the album.
Oh, so that was been awesome.
Very powerful. Mm-hmm. I mean, a completely unknown world, this barbershop world, which, like the Boy Scouts, has changed radically today. But then, back then in the late 70s, for me, it just represented an adventure.
Yeah, magic.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Magic.
It was freaking magical. And by the way, it's the same kind of magic that my grandfather had. You know, I often described him as a magician because he would wake up clean and come home dirty. And somewhere during the course of the day, a problem had been solved. A roof had been put on. A foundation had been poured. Electricity suddenly appeared where there was none. I always looked at the trades as a kind of magic, and I looked at the arts as a kind of magic. And I think maybe that's why I'm still drawn to both.
And so now let's talk about the magic that you've made as an adult. It's interesting to me, as I looked at your work of doing these 300 episodes of Dirty Jobs, and we talk about the S-curve of learning, and you continually, every time you went on to a new job, you were jumping to a brand new S-curve. And I'm wondering if you can tell us about an experience that you had where you were a particularly memorable new guy on the job experience. I mean, we have talked a little bit about that, of being in high school, but once you went on the job and you were doing the concrete finishing or something else, what was an experience that you had of being brand new on the job?
That's the question of my life, you know, and the 350-page book I can't get around to finishing. But the short version, I think, has to start with what happened to me between the opera, which Fred King also insisted I audition for, and I wound up getting in and staying for 8 years, right? I mean, what the hell? It's statistically impossible. But while I was singing in the opera from 1982 to 1990, I was also freelancing like crazy all through Baltimore, New York, and DC, doing commercial work and narrating shows. And during that time, from 82 to 90, I got my toolbox together for real. I got school behind me. I did a lot of plays. I did a lot of writing, and I figured out that I had some useful skills. And the way I applied them was very local and very specific. Then in the opera, I wound up auditioning for the QVC cable shopping channel just to settle a bet. I was dressed as a Viking. In fact, I walked across the street from the Lyric Opera House to the Mount Royal Tavern during an intermission of Doringus Nibelungen, and QVC was on the TV, and the bartender was watching it. I wanted to watch the football game, but he was watching this because he was auditioning the next day. QVC had come to town and they were having a cattle call. Anyway, I auditioned for QVC. I get hired. I wind up spending 3 years in the home shopping industry. And when I left, fired for the third time from QVC, this is 1993. And now I'm really armed and dangerous. I had just spent 3 years selling things in the middle of the night with no script. I became very comfortable on live TV and I was ready to jump into the business for real. And I did. And so from 1993 until 2001, I probably had 400 jobs working for the History Channel, for Nat Geo, for the Discovery Channel, impersonating a host for anybody who would hire me, infomercials, regular commercials, documentaries, talk shows, pilots. I mean, my business model in those days was really focused not on finding a hit, but on touching everything like it was hot. Ideally, I would look for projects that were so poorly conceived and so doomed to fail that I had no chance of getting stuck in a contract. And I would always do my best work and people always liked me. So I was always easy to hire again, but I really embraced the Travis McGee model.
So you were really consciously tried to get stuff that you didn't think would be a hit.
Absolutely. I became very arrogant in a really unique way because I had a lot of friends at that point who were in the business and they were all swinging for the fences. And most of them were eating Top Ramen and living paycheck to paycheck as best they could. I was doing pretty great. I could work whenever I wanted. I was good at what I did and I had no interest. The revelation was you don't have to be afraid of failing in Hollywood because 99% of all the projects that get lit up fail. And so if most people, most of my friends anyway, were worried about being associated with bad ideas, I looked for bad ideas because you get paid to work on bad ideas. And if you don't mind being a part of a ship that sinks, you know, if you got your life preserver on and you know there are other ships in the area, then it's not so scary. That's who I was until I was 42 years old. And at that point, I was working for CBS here in San Francisco, hosting a show called Evening Magazine, an unusual steady gig for me. But again, I had all the time off I wanted. It was a really easy job. That's the answer to your question. That's the day my mother called to tell me that my grandfather, who was 91 at the time, she said, "Michael, you know, your grandfather is not going to be around forever." And then she said something that completely, I guess it's one of those S-curves. She said, "It would be terrific if before he died, he could turn on the television and see you doing something that looked like work."
Wow. Body blow.
So, right? So there I am, the host of Evening Magazine, working for CBS, sitting in my cubicle and getting this call from my mother. And of course, she was right. So that's the day I thought, you know, this show, Evening Magazine, it was on every night. And I always hosted it from wineries or art openings or restaurants. I could go anywhere in the city I wanted to host this show. And I thought, why not host it from a factory floor or a construction site or a sewer? And I called the city supervisor and told him I wanted to host an episode of Evening Magazine from a sewer in San Francisco. And he said, okay. And so the next morning I went into the sewers of San Francisco with my cameraman. And what happened in there, you know, if you read the book, you know what happened in there.
But tell us, because it's an amazing story. Tell everybody else.
The sewer rose up against me. You know, there was a sewage worker in there named Gene Cruz, who was sort of my guide and he was a sewer inspector. He had work to do down there. My job was simply to host the show and throw to the various segments in the show. But every time I tried, something horrible happened. You know, a lateral exploded, for instance, these pipes in the walls of the sewer where the raw sewage, you know, flies into the main tunnel every time somebody flushes their toilet. You know, I'm squatting there in about a foot of indescribable filth trying to open the show while my cameraman is filming me, and the lateral blows up and hits me in the side of the face, which is pretty funny TV, but, you know, a heck of a way to, not what I was expecting.
Yeah.
We were ultimately, I mean, I can't tell you the whole story, Whitney, because it really would take 2 hours, but I was covered by many thousands of thumb-sized roaches. I was covered in the effluvium of the fine folks from San Francisco. I was basically assaulted by a rat the size of a loaf of bread who drove me face first into the aforementioned sludge. Basically, I was baptized in a river of crap as I was trying to host this sweet little show called Evening Magazine. And at that point, about an hour into this fiasco, Gene, the sewer inspector, who was busy hammering out bricks in the main line and replacing them, that was his job, he looked over his shoulder and on camera he said, "Hey, if you're done screwing around with the local wildlife, why don't you come over here and give me a hand?" And so at that point, why not? I couldn't do my job. You know, I couldn't host the show the way I was supposed to. So I went over and interviewed this guy while I helped him replace the bricks in the wall of the sewer of San Francisco. And while that happened, my cameraman filmed the whole thing. And long story short, when I got back to the studio, I looked at all the footage. You know, I looked at the footage of me getting covered with filth. I looked at the roaches falling down my shirt. I looked at the hilarity that ensued. I looked at the rat that drove me face first into the sludge. And then I listened to the conversation I had with Gene, and I was blown away by it. All of the facts that I had attempted to articulate myself as a host came out in the course of the conversation, not from me, from Gene, who is an actual expert, who actually knows what he's talking about. He wasn't impersonating a host. He was just being himself. And as I watched that interview unfold on my desk back at CBS, what I thought might be a model for a new kind of show, a show that didn't have a host, but had a guest instead, a show that relied not on an expert at the center, but on experts around the edges, right? So that footage became a short segment on Evening Magazine called Somebody's Got to Do It. And when it aired, it got me fired, of course, because people are sitting down to watch their beloved Evening Magazine. You know, it's dinner time, they're having their meatloaf, and there I am crawling through just a river of crap, being a smart aleck, you know. It was the wrong segment for that show, but I loved it. And when we parted ways, CBS let me have the footage. I showed the footage to Discovery. It changed the name to Dirty Jobs. And I began a new phase of my career at 42. I completely abandoned my model of looking for losers. I abandoned the idea that the work didn't matter, but the lifestyle did. I went to work, honestly, for the first time in my life. And I went to work with a vengeance. It was a show that was inspired by my grandfather, motivated by a phone call from my mother that was able to incorporate the sort of artistry that Ed King instilled in me and the kind of diligence that Mr. Huntington, my scoutmaster, demanded. It was the show that changed everything. And so from 2003 until 2012, I produced Dirty Jobs. And I went to every state half a dozen times. We did over 300 shows. We profiled over 300 people like Gene Cruz. it was at that moment in the sewer and every other moment on Dirty Jobs where I felt like a fish out of water. My job was to be an apprentice. It was Groundhog's Day for me in a sewer. And it was terrific.
Did your grandfather get to see you?
Once. He saw the first episode.
Oh.
Yeah.
So perfect.
Yep. You have to imagine, too, this guy, this man's man who gave me the advice he gave me all those years ago. Really, he was probably just trying to get me out of his hair, to be honest. I was a nightmare on the job site. And then, to his horror, here I am singing in the Baltimore Opera, doing community theater. I'm like, what in the world are you doing? But look, he was always super supportive, but to know at the end, you know, he saw the beginning of Dirty Jobs, that was pretty great.
I was going to ask you to talk about a high end of the S curve, but actually we just talked about it because you were on the high end of an S curve in terms of the life that you had when you were 42, always looking for losers. You were making enough money and then you get that phone call from your mom who basically pushes you existentially, if you will, off that S curve, and it starts a new life. In many ways, it's a hero's journey, and it's just lovely. I want to read a quote to you, and I think I know the answer, but let's see where this goes. So David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, said this, and I'm going to paraphrase. He says, most people don't form a self and then lead a life. They're called by a problem, and the self is constructed gradually by their calling. Would you say you've now found your calling?
Maybe. Maybe, but I'm hesitant to say definitely, because what do you do once you find your calling? You're like, what do you do with that? So much of my own identity has been based on the search that I'm honestly not sure how to feel about finding it, whatever it is. I will tell you that I feel really for the first time a kind of congruency. You know, the Dirty Jobs is over, except for the fact that now they want to reboot it. And I might do that for a variety of reasons. But the thing that brought everything together for me was a foundation called MicroWorks. And again, this was never part of the game plan. When I look back at how my foundation started 12 years ago on Labor Day, the day Fred King died, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Fitting.
Yeah. I mean, a month or two before that, this would have been 2008, our Dirty Jobs was the number one show on cable, and our economy was starting to crash. We were entering a recession, and everywhere I went, I saw these help wanted signs, even as unemployment numbers were going through the roof. It was very strange, you know, to hear on Dirty Jobs how the people I met struggled mightily to find skilled workers, even as our unemployment rates eclipsed 10%, you know, strange. And I began to realize that I might be able to do something useful for the industries that had allowed Dirty Jobs to prosper. And that was make a more persuasive case for, at the time, 2.3 million jobs that were open that nobody seemed excited about. And so I challenged the fans of Dirty Jobs to help build a trade resource center online, which would direct people to these many millions of opportunities that didn't require a four-year degree, but instead required the mastery of a skill. And once that trade resource got built, I took it upon myself to talk about it. And during 2009, 2010, when things were really pretty dark out there, I was going to Congress and testifying about the need for a national PR campaign to do a better job of shining a light on these opportunities that really existed and would be a terrific way for so many people to get back into the workforce. I wrote a letter to President Obama at the time and said, look, you're talking about 3 million shovel-ready jobs, as if the country is willing to pick up a shovel. But I'm afraid to tell you that much of the country is not willing to do that. And the evidence is apocryphal, but it's mine, and I've seen it for years, and you're going to run into a problem if you don't do something to celebrate these jobs and awaken in our society a new level of appreciation for the men and women who do this kind of work, then you're going to have a very hard time filling shovel-ready positions. That's what I was up to with the foundation in the early days. And that PR campaign is alive and well today, and the foundation has since evolved into a scholarship fund. We give away $1 million a year in work ethic scholarships. And when I started doing that, that's when it felt to me like, I won't say it's my calling, but it felt, you know how when you write, sometimes it comes together in a way that almost sounds like a box closing in your mind. It goes click, right?
Yeah.
That actually happened just a month or two ago in July of 2020. We gave away $1 million. And I started doing something I hadn't been able to do, which is go back 4 or 5 years and contact our scholarship recipients and start interviewing them on camera to see how, just to see how they're doing.
Yep.
Beyond awesome. I mean, I can't tell you how many welders we trained who are now debt-free making six figures a year. I can't tell you how many welders went on to pick up a plumbing certification and then bought a van and then hired a helper and then bought another van and branched out into heating, air conditioning, electric, and now have a dozen employees and a going concern because somebody came along and said, hey, look, it doesn't have to be a 4-year degree. You don't have to borrow $80,000. You don't have to declare a major at a time in your life when you don't know your ass from a hot rock. Pardon me, but that's what I was saying. You know, there is another way. And so now I've got hundreds of stories of people who actually did get the gene that I didn't get from my grandfather, whose minds are in fact wired for this kind of work and who are thriving as a result of it. So have I found my calling? I don't know, but I do know when I look back at how lost I felt at 17 and how my mom stepped in at just the right time to say, hey, do something your grandfather would recognize as work, and how Fred King stepped in at just the right time to say, hey, why don't you act like a kid who doesn't stutter just for grins? If it wasn't for those moments and those people, then, you know, I wouldn't be 58 years old today talking to you about a girl named Chloe, who I just interviewed 2 days ago, who's making $140,000 a year welding in a nuclear facility up in New England somewhere. A woman who was about to go into medical school to study plastic surgery, but panicked at the last minute because the amount of the debt freaked her out and decided instead to learn to weld. I swear, Whitney, if you saw this woman, you would, she's beautiful. She's talented. She's one of the best welders I've ever seen, and she's happy. So it's a crooked road, you know, that we take. And there are lots of twists and turns, lots of S's, as you would say.
Yes, there are. So I want to read a couple of quotes, just three things that you've said, and maybe you can just comment on those and then we'll wrap up. But what would the world look like if no one did this job? You have me crying. You need to know this. I am crying right now. I'm so moved by these stories. Who are the essential workers that get dirty on our behalf doing things we don't understand? And then you said something in your TED Talk that was really powerful to me. Innovation and imitation, clean and dirty, are two sides of the same coin. And then my final question to you is, what would the world look like if no one did your job?
Well, it'd be a lot cleaner, that's for sure. I mean, kidding aside, I don't know what the world would look like if I weren't in it. That's classic Jimmy Stewart right there. You know, and in fact, I've often talked about It's a Wonderful Life in the context of everything we're talking about. You know, fundamentally, it should be a question, you know, that's always top of mind, because that question will invariably lead to a heightened level of appreciation level of appreciation is the most important thing, I believe, with regard to getting a more balanced workforce, which is the goal of my foundation. Having said that, I have no idea what the world would look like if no one was doing what I'm doing, but I can tell you, modesty aside, that cable TV, for better or worse, would look very different. When Dirty Jobs premiered, there was no reality television. Not really. There was Survivor, which was a reality competition show. And there was Jesse James, you know, building hot rods and motorcycles in his garage. Dirty Jobs was unlike anything anyone had ever seen. And since it premiered, something like 32 or 34 shows evolved out of that format, directly out of that show. People we profiled went on to do their own shows. And so, again, I don't want the credit and I don't want the blame, but after Dirty Jobs, cable TV became a landscape of Alaskan bush pilots and alligator hunters in the Atchafalaya Swamp and the entirety of Nat Geo history and discovery today would not look anything like it looks had my grandfather not told me to get a different toolbox.
Any final thoughts?
You mentioned something about innovation and imitation. And I did say that at that TED Talk. And it's one of the examples I sometimes use about the dangers of conventional wisdom. In fact, the first time I said that, Motorola hired me to come to something called an innovation symposium to talk to their people about the importance of innovation. And, you know, obviously I'm not qualified to do that. I'm not qualified to do half the things I do, but I said, sure. And, my message was, look, why are you having an innovation seminar? Why aren't you having an imitation seminar? And I pulled out my cell phone at the time, which was a Motorola product. And I said, look, I get it. You guys look at this thing and you innovated it. And so you've hired a marketing team and your PR people have all come together and you've decided that your identity is going to be that of the great innovator. And innovation is at the center of Silicon Valley. It's at the center of so many identities, both the micro and macro, and businesses and individuals. Your business is successful, not just because you innovated this phone, but because you've imitated it perfectly many millions of times over. If you can't imitate your innovation, then you're just in the business of making prototypes. And that's not a business at all. That's just building monuments to yourself. And as I thought about that, it struck me that that's exactly what we've done with education. We've elevated four-year degrees at the expense of all the alternatives. That's why we have $1.6 trillion in student loans. That's why we have millions of open positions that don't require a four-year degree. We gravitate one thing, often at the expense of another thing. And what comes out the end are bromides and platitudes and the kinds of tropes that normally wind up hanging on the walls of boardrooms. Images of people in a rowing skull, for instance, with a caption that says, persistence, they stay the course. But they don't bother to tell you that the course only makes sense if you're going in the right direction. And so challenging conventional advice, challenging bromides, that might be my calling, if I actually have one, is to say that, you know, in your vernacular, don't forget about the S curve, because this course you're determined to stay on might have other ideas. You might be so fixated on your destination, you're just in the wrong direction. We don't know. You know, it's fluid, and I'm suspicious of anybody who says they do know, which is why the self-help books on my shelf are mostly unread. I'm making it up as I go, honestly. And for my money, the most interesting people I know would say the same thing.
Mike Rove, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I hope I said something cogent.
I learned a lot from my conversation with Mike, and I hope you did too. Here are my takeaways. Number one, find a different toolbox. The advice Mike got from his grandfather was so important, but sometimes it can be really hard to hear that kind of advice. Convincing Mike to apply his skills elsewhere was a life-changing gift, and we can all thank his grandfather for it. Number two, get uncomfortable. When his music teacher assigned him a solo despite his speech impediment, Mike said he felt threatened, frightened, and profoundly uncomfortable. And yet that push was key to getting him out of his shell and set him on a path to the performing arts. Often, moments of extreme discomfort and uncertainty lead to great things. Number three, it can be good to seek failure. Mike shared his unusual mindset. He looked for bad ideas and was happy to get paid to work on projects that were doomed to fail. This removed all the stakes and freed him up to experiment and take risks. And some of those dirty risks, they led to dirty jobs. What did you learn from our conversation with Mike? What risks are you taking these days, and what are your fears about them? Please email me at wj@whitneyjohnson.com. I'd love to hear, and I do take the time to read and respond to every email. And oh, by the way, we have 10 signed copies of Mike's book, The Way I Heard It, which you will be eligible for when I hear from you. Thank you again to Mike Rove for being our guest. Thank you to you for listening. And thank you to our team, Matt Silverman, producer, Whitney Job, audio engineer and editor, Steve Ludwig, assistant producer, and Maddie McDaniel, production assistant. I'm your host, Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself. Disruption.